Hello, and welcome to Diving Into Diabetes, the podcast where we explore the latest advances in best practices on individualized diabetes care. I'm your host, Dr. Alice Chang from Toronto, Canada, and with me on the program is Dr. Bruce Perkins, professor, endocrinologist, epidemiologist, and clinician scientist in the Faculty of Medicine and the Institute for Health Policy Management and Evaluation at the University of Toronto. He is an international leader in diabetes research, particularly in the type 1 diabetes space. And among his many accomplishments, he sits on the executive of the ongoing landmark DCCT EDIC study, truly the gift that keeps on giving in type 1 diabetes. He is the perfect person to have on this podcast episode to help us understand the roots of type 1 diabetes. Welcome, Bruce.
Thanks, Alice. It's always a real pleasure to speak with you.
So let's start with some of the basics here. Can you tell us what are the key differentiators between type 1 and type 2 diabetes?
Yeah, it's a great question. It can get tricky. So the first thing to say is that type 1 versus type 2 diabetes, that classification is a classification that we kind of wish existed, but doesn't always exist. There can be blurry lines. But the first thing is that most cases are easy to differentiate. So think of type 1 diabetes as an autoimmune destruction that through no fault of one's own, antibodies start getting produced, likely over months or years, against insulin-producing cells. And then all of a sudden, someone presents with clinical diabetes, hyperglycemia, and this ketosis-prone state. Those are kind of key features. Now, they tend to be younger, but it can occur at any age, just not in the first 6 months of life. And if you were to draw an average, it would be around 20. So actually, it's fewer than half that are kids or adolescents at diagnosis. The historic teaching is they tend to be Caucasian, less likely to have higher risk ethnicities, as in type 2 diabetes, and that they tend to lack insulin resistance risk factors, so they tend to be thinner, more active, etc. But there can be a lot of overlap between those. The gift when you see someone with type 1 diabetes is if they have an autoimmune disease history, or that they have risk factors for autoimmunity because of a family history of autoimmunity, and that they otherwise don't look like type 2 diabetes. So then type 2 diabetes, on the other hand, is rather than this beta cell destruction occurring immediately, there is insulin resistance that puts a stress over time on the beta cell so that it starts to fail through no fault of one's own as well. And those risk factors include overweight, obesity, here certain high-risk ethnicities like First Nations or Hispanic, Southeast Asian ethnicities, lower physical activity. And type 2 diabetes has very typically a very strong family history. So those are kind of some key things that help us to differentiate. And I'll get into some other things later that can help us to confirm, like looking at ketones, for example, in urine, or looking at antibody levels.
So that's very helpful, Bruce. And that description that you gave sounds like there's potentially overlap, as well as maybe needing to think a bit more broadly, because classically in medical school decades ago, I mean, I was taught typically Caucasian child or adolescent, family history of type 1, lower body weight, DKA, that person has type 1. And what you're saying is that that person may be what's shown in textbooks, but that we should be thinking more broadly in terms of who can develop type 1 diabetes.
Yeah, that's true. So in the endocrine community and the family medicine community, there'll be plenty of examples of people who really look like type 2 diabetes or look like type 1. But then their natural history doesn't follow that course, or that they're certain there's type 1 diabetes, but there aren't the classic antibody that we've measured clinically that's present.
Now, you've told us that autoimmunity is a hallmark of type 1 diabetes, and perhaps one of the things that can help us, in fact, differentiate between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So what specific autoantibodies are we talking about, and what triggers the islet autoimmunity in type 1 diabetes?
Yeah, great questions. So, I mean, the first thing, in my career, at least in the first part of my career, and we're somewhat contemporaries, you and I, the diagnosis of type 1 versus type 2 was like purely a clinical diagnosis. But now we have availability of autoantibodies that we can measure. So which are the specific ones? So we've had commercially available for quite some time, the GAD antibody or GAD65, that stands for glutamic acid decarboxylase. You know, it's not exact, it's somehow related to the neural and endocrine connection in type 1 diabetes, but it is present in a good 80% or so of people who seem to definitively have type 1 diabetes. But now there's others that we can measure. And in fact, some of these are kind of broadly available across Canada, not consistently. And there's a lot of work going towards getting more consistent antibody levels. But I'll just tell you what those are. So they include other islet and beta cell antigens, things like zinc transporter 8, we call ZNT8, zinc transporter 8. There's also the microinsulin autoantibody, which is an antibody against insulin. There's the insulinoma associated antigen 2 antibody, and that is also somehow related to the beta cell, but was kind of developed in the insulinoma identification research realm. And then there's one called the fifth, there are five that I've just listed now, called islet cell antibodies. And what it is, it's a kind of a bit of a messier test that has variability between labs, and it's measuring a bunch of these other antibodies. So really there's GAD, zinc transporter 8, microinsulin autoantibodies, this insulinoma-associated antigen 2, and then the broad islet cell antibody assay. You asked me, actually, if I remember correctly, what triggers there are for this. And we don't fully understand this. We think there are stressors and maybe risk factors like smoking, et cetera, but we don't exactly know the triggers for the autoantibody production.
Now, most of us are used to thinking about type 1 diabetes as a single clinical stage with hyperglycemia, right? Because that's usually how we see it manifest to us clinically. But in fact, there are multiple stages of type 1 diabetes, and you sort of alluded to this a little bit already. Can you walk us through those stages and how are they actually defined? Because I think this piece of information is going to be new to many of our listeners, but yet going to be very important in terms of how we approach people.
Yeah, I think the clinical context here, Alice, is that type 1 diabetes was never something we screened for, like subclinical stages. We just dealt with someone when they presented with dramatic hyperglycemic symptoms or ketoacidosis. But those antibodies that I've just talked about give us an opportunity to identify the stages prior to that clinical development. So the way it's defined now through research, and now clinical staging is seen this way as well, so we should all be aware of it. Diabetes is essentially in, let's say, 3 to 4 stages, call it 4 stages. So stage 1 is when someone has those antibodies that I mentioned. Of the 5 assays that someone could do, they say multiple. So 2 or more really states that someone's at risk now of progressing at some point in their lives towards clinical diabetes. That's called stage 1, positive antibodies, 2 or more. Stage 2 is when that person with antibodies has now developed dysglycemia. So that means that impaired glucose tolerance range. So if they had an OGTT, it would be in that impaired range of 7.8 to 11, or impaired fasting glucose in the range of 6 to 6.9. Random glucoses that are also elevating towards 11, as in an OGTT. So that's stage 2. Antibodies plus some dysglycemia, but not clinical hyperglycemia yet. Stage 3 is the clinical hyperglycemia, meeting those criteria of 11.1 or above and an OGTT, et cetera. And I hadn't mentioned A1C. We can use A1C for the pre-diabetes stage in stage 2, and A1C up to 6.4, then 6.5 and above for a clinical diagnosis of diabetes. And then it is said that stage 4 is when someone's moved on through their clinical diabetes and developed complications, et cetera. But these are the key stages, stage 1 to 3, where we've got antibodies, then dysglycemia in stage 2, and then clinical diabetes in stage 3.
Very helpful for us to sort of broaden the way we think about type 1 diabetes. So finally, what is the current and potential clinical utility of understanding these stages and identifying people in the different stages?
Yeah, well, this is where we really need to ante up and make a difference clinically in the lives of people who are going to develop type 1 diabetes. So the first real clinical benefit is identifying someone who now, even though we don't exactly know when they'll develop clinical diabetes, to know that they're roughly 10 to 20 year horizon is really high. They can be educated around understanding symptoms for the specific purpose of preventing diabetic ketoacidosis. That's actually really important. DKA at diagnosis can be fatal. It's a major morbidity. We need to work to prevent that. But the second reason, you know, internationally in other countries, there's availability of a medication to help delay the onset of type 1 diabetes, which we should all be aware of, and we should hope for its inclusion in Canada as well. So we have to start getting ready to think about identifying people at preclinical stages so we can prevent DKA and potentially implement new interventions.
Excellent. So thank you. Thank you, Dr. Bruce Perkins, for sharing your expertise with us today. And thank you to our audience for listening to this latest installment of the Diving Into Diabetes podcast. I certainly learned a lot and enjoyed our discussion on understanding the root of type 1 diabetes. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and stay tuned for new releases.